some kind of a local effect, the way your trees are sifted the signal or whatever, because an awful lot of guys use ground plane antennas on those bands, so there should be a good number of verticals. I'm getting the impression from what you're saying, you haven't given me numbers, but I'm going to make a guess that you're telling me 75% of the signals you heard were strongest horizontal and 25% were vertical. I wonder if that's sort of what you've experienced, Glenn. KC2QIQ, K2LIW.
When I'm talking to people on vertical antennas that are using like those Cushcraft and the other verticals, those definitely are unique. I mean, you can hear them, and I have to definitely spin the beam vertical, and their signal picks up quite a bit. So definitely I know when they actually have one of those antennas going through them. They're not the rule. They're not the majority out there, but yes, they do. And the mobiles are also unique. I can almost always tell a mobile, even sometimes when they're in fixed locations, because they definitely have a very strange kind of polarization. And I think it's because their antenna is firing ground objects. So there I sometimes have to play around with the polarization to determine, a mobile, but because they're not always pure vertical polarization from the lips that are on the car. So I do get some strange effects there. But certainly, ground station to ground station, if they're horizontal, they stay horizontal. If they're vertical, they stay vertical. And I've noticed this now for, pretty much the... And as a matter of fact, when I talk to ground stations that have vertical antennas and horizontal antennas, I can see the shift immediately once they switch from one to the other. And I can tell, oh, yep, you're on vertical now. Oh, yep, you're on horizontal. And that's DX and survey. So, as I said, I haven't seen the effects of priority rotation. That's not to say that it isn't possible or it isn't happening, but I just haven't witnessed it in the last 4.5 years, even through the sunspot cycle. K2RIWKC2QIQ.
Yeah, at the transmission, there was a feedback of the audio, so it looks like somebody's putting the carrier into it.
The fact that you see so little extraordinary polarization is still kind of amazing to me, particularly on DX stations, Glenn. Lou, I think you wanted to make a comment. NY2H, K2RW, go ahead.
Negative, I was just commenting on Glenn's audio. But since you brought it up, do you remember, this is a little bit off topic, but it was from before, Neanderthals, where the current modern-day region is, which has the most DNA right now, which is traced back to Neanderthal.
My recollection of the PBS program is that the Neanderthals seem to have originated in Northern Europe. The non-Neanderthals seem to have originated in Central Africa. And as the groups in Central Africa migrated north and encountered the Neanderthals, that's where the intermarriage or intermixing seemed to have taken place. That's my understanding of... I didn't see the program, in one sitting down from beginning to end. I saw it in pieces. So that's my recollection of what I saw, Lou. And they did appear to have two rather different origins. But we're slowly discovering, if I understand correctly from the program, that all of these negative characteristics we used to attach to Neanderthals, we thought they were big, homely, stupid, and got overpowered by the non-Neanderthals. There's a lot of evidence that that's not true once you properly look at it, at the whole situation, that a fair amount of intermixing took place, and one became more dominant than the other. But still, the modern-day Homo sapien, each one of us has a certain percentage of Neanderthal DNA within us. So it wasn't just a simple obsolescence is not the right word. Becoming obsolete. I can't think of the right word. It's one completely fading out compared to the other. Was nowhere near as simple as that. and they were apparently equipped with language capability and making sophisticated tools. Back to you, Lou. NY2HKQLIW.
Yeah, so the winner was, I think, averaging about 5%, somewhere around there. Tuscany, the Tuscany region of Italy.
Uh-oh. Hey, Lou, what do you read into that? Go ahead, Lou.
Well, I don't read anything into it. I think the Asians had a very low percentage. And you're right, I guess the Ice Age in Europe is when the Neanderthals had their heyday. And their lifespan was, I think, about 30 years. But they did learn. I saw the tool making you talked about. And it was quite a process, especially that last blow that they had to do onto the rock, et cetera. And what they came up with seemed to be a very sturdy tool for cutting meat. And it seemed to just be engineered almost perfectly. So that's it. Back to you.
And develop a skill like that requires quite a bit of one person passing information on to another, language capability, data transfer capability. Go ahead, Sean. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Columbus was a savior.
Well, don't forget, Tuscany had the Etruscans, and they were doing operations of the skull and dental work, but yet had no written language at the time. Definite area of investigation. Great stuff.
And Columbus was a savior.
So it's far from simple as I see it. Let me jump over to Jim before he has to go to sleep tonight, to go to school tomorrow. Wait a minute, yes, school tomorrow is Monday. I wonder if you had a chance, Jim, to fire your Kenwood TS-520 barefoot into your antenna. Were you able to load it up and see what looks like a reasonable power output? KD2-BHY. K2RIW. Go ahead, Jim.
A few, I'd say 30 minutes ago, I fired it up and I tuned it into the antenna and I called CQ on 40 and 20 meters on a couple different frequencies for a good 20, 25 minutes. And I couldn't really, I didn't really stir anything up. I didn't make any contacts, and I only heard one station on each band. So I'm kind of confused.
Yeah, this time of night, I wouldn't think that all of those bands would be closed. The fact that you only heard one station on each band is a little bit mysterious. You have reason to believe that your antenna has a reasonable standing wave ratio, Jim. Is there a way you can measure forward power and reverse power on the transmission line when you're loading the antenna? How sharply the tuning and loading controls operate is another strong clue. If the antenna is a very high standing wave ratio, you get very sharp tuning, whereas you get much more broad tuning if the antenna is more reasonable. So, do you have the ability to see forward and reverse power and or standing wave ratio with any of the things that you own? Like maybe, although the antenna tuner is not required to be used, in some cases the antenna tuner matchbox will have a so-called bypass mode where the signal just simply flows straight through it with no operation, but yet still it does have an output standing wave ratio indicating device. Output/input. So what do you believe is the standing wave ratio of your antenna if you happen to know, Jim? KD2BHY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I can find out. I have the bypass on my tuner. If you want me to find out, I will. It does tune up very sharply.
So that's a little bit mysterious. The fact that it tunes sharply, the fact that you only hear one signal, it does suggest the antenna could be less than ideal. It could be a short circuit or an open circuit in the way the antenna is wired. You have reason to believe that the way the transmission line joins your antenna, the center conductor and the shield are kept reasonably far apart. They're not likely to be wrapped together in shorting. some amount of weatherproofing so that water is not pouring into the cable. When people run into a problem with a dipole-like antenna, it's usually where the transmission line meets the antenna is the area of grief. So describe to me the that junction on your antenna, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW.
Well, first of all, it's an off-center fit dipole. 20, and I think it's a couple of them, but mainly 40 and 20. It's, I think there's a balance. It was given to me by a ham, there's a balance, and then there are two wires on the end, which is pretty basic knowledge, but that's what I can give you. I'm using RG58 with SO239 connectors. I mean, a little bit of water might have gotten into it.
Yeah, I'm guessing you're on your handy talkie, Jim, because you did move around and you went into some pretty deep fades on that transmission. So there's an ideal location where you can hold the handy, and you better go back there. You did say it's an off-center fit dipole. I wonder what kind of a balun it has. Being fed with RG58 into an SO239, I think you said, PL239. So what kind of a balun device, off-center fed dipole? That could be Wyndham. Wyndham is one of the kinds of popular off-center fed dipole. So describe that junction and the balun if there is one, Jim. KD2BHY, K2RIW.
There is a balance. I'm not really sure. I don't really have good vocabulary for this stuff, but there is a balance, and I mean, all I really know is that there's an SO239 connector connected there, and I guess there might be some water damage. I'm not really sure.
Well, whether or not water got in there, there's ways you can inspect that and find out if water got in there. There's a whole lot of ways you can test that. Take the balancing device and shake it, see if you hear water. Carefully open up the connections and see if water pours out. See if everything looks dry and weatherproofed and properly taped together and so on. But whatever means, your antenna tuner or matchbox, many of them do have a ability to measure standing wave ratio of the antenna, even when the antenna tuner is being used in the bypass mode, where the signal flows through and doesn't go through any of the tuning network. So I think your next step is to find out what is the apparent standing wave ratio in the shack for that antenna. Also, when it comes to the balun you're describing, I presume the balun is mounted right at the antenna. In other words, the two halves of the antenna that come together go to this balancing device. Is that true, Jim? KD2BHY, K2RIW.
That's correct.
I think you were starting to say that's correct, but we only heard that's cut. So there was a sudden dropout of your signal. Maybe battery or something like that. So I think that's your next step. Confirm the antenna has reasonable standing wave ratio. If the antenna is a short circuit or an open circuit, only allowing you to hear one strong signal, that's a bit mysterious. And you're not going to get answers very easily with that situation. Also, depending on how much power you're really putting out, there are occasions when you answer someone else's CQ, you'll have a much higher probability of getting an answer than when you send out a CQ. If you're a high-power station, yeah, no problem. If you're a low-power station, for whatever reason, like the transmitter going into some kind of a protect mode, well, wait a minute now, a Kenwood 520 does not have a protect mode, to my knowledge. In other words, that transmitter plugged into a high standing wave ratio antenna will still try to put out full power. It doesn't have a protect mode, I believe. So standing wave ratio is the next thing for you to confirm, Jim. And even if you have trouble confirming that, getting someone to volunteer to come over to your house with a Bird wattmeter and measure forward and reverse power and therefore interpret that into standing wave ratio, that's a reasonable thing for you to request. That's the next step to confirm you've got a real antenna there, Jim. 82BHY, K2RIW.
Yeah, I can measure SWR like that. I do have a bypass thing on the tuner, and I do remember the SWR being a bit ridiculous. Not that I could really measure it completely, but I remember the reflected power being something. I mean, it's a needle violently showing up.
Okay, if you did see a whole lot of reflected power and the needle almost pegged on return power, that's a strong indication, if it's being used correctly, the VISWR meter, that something is correct, something is wrong with the antenna, and corrective action is required. A physical inspection is a good first step. Looking for water is a good first step. Confirming that the standing wave ratio is high, and that's got to be corrected before you can proceed. If your standing wave ratio was, let me pick a number, 3-1, on a Kenwood 520, no problem. If the real standing wave ratio is 10-1 or 20-1, really high numbers, then it's time to apply corrective action. But a 3-1 standing wave ratio, if it was real, a Kenwood 520 would handle that with no problem. Many other rigs in modern days, solid state, no tune rigs, would go crazy on a 3-1. They want a 1.5 maximum. A 3-1 on a 520, Kenwood 520, no problem. So it's time for you to quantify the standing wave ratio on each of the bands you care about. I mean, if you get a high standing wave ratio on 20 meters, but a low standing wave ratio on 10 meters, that's a good piece of information. If you get a high standing wave ratio in every single band, that's a strong indication. So go gather some information, Jim. KD2BHY for any other fills, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, I definitely get high SWR on every band. Yeah, I think it's some ridiculous number. I think I'll check for water damage tomorrow. What do I do if it is water damage?
Dick, WHSCDL, I have additional information to help him.
Yeah, Andy recognized. Jim, you called it water damage. I would call it water detriment. In other words, during the time the water is inside the ballon will not behave anywhere near as well as it should. You'll get lower performance while the water is there. Very rarely does water permanently damage an antenna. You simply eliminate the water and you're back in operation. But it sounds like Andy's got some good suggestions for you. W2CDL, K2RIW. Go ahead, Andy.
Okay. Jim, just to mention, the drive control on your radio does two things. It picks up the, on transmit, it picks up the drive level for maximum power output, and on receive, it picks up the preselector, the front end of the radio. So it's possible if you're only trying to receive a signal, maybe your drive control is not peaked to the band that you're on. So just make sure that when you hear the noise level increase, just be, without having a signal to look at, you'll just hear the background noise level of the radio increase as you peak the drive control on the band that you're on. So it's possible maybe your drive is not peaked, and that's the reason why you're not receiving any signals, or very weak. So, Dick, back to you.
Yeah, Jim, has anyone ever visited you with a bird watt meter and or a visual inspection of your antenna by which they measured the standing wave ratio? Maybe the answer is no. The fact that you've measured what you believe to be very high standing wave ratio on multiple bands certainly suggests that there is something that needs correction. There could be a short circuit somewhere in the middle of your cable, maybe right at the connector in the shack. That's a very simple place to have what looks like a good connection, but it's a short circuit. Depending on the kind of antenna you've got, in many cases, simply putting an ohm meter in the shack by opening up the cable, you know, disconnecting it from the transmitter and putting an ohm meter between center conductor and shield. Depending on the design of your antenna and the way the balun works, many an antenna, there should be an open circuit there. And with water, you'll measure 10,000 ohms as opposed to an open circuit. That would be a strong indication of water. Although, you got to be careful with that one. Some antennas, by the way the antenna is designed, there's the equivalent of an RF choke in there. Let me drop it. Where the antenna is a good impedance match at radio frequencies, but at DC frequencies, which is the way the ohm meter works, there's a short circuit that the ohm meter will see. In which case, looking for the short circuit, in other words, if there's 30 feet of RG58 transmission line, and it should have 2 ohms of resistance, and you measure 2 ohms, that implies that the cable is working correctly. So properly interpreting an ohm meter measurement can give you another clue. So there's a bunch of things you can do to find out if the antenna is behaving correctly. I think up till now you have not had a strong indication of a good working antenna, obvious by high standing wave ratio, not hearing very many signals, and not getting very many responses to your CQ. So the common denominator here in all of this seems to be the antenna. That's going to require some further work and some further measurements and observations and taking apart and sniffing, and if you know what I mean. Back to you, Jim, for any other comments. KD2BHY.
Station Dick.
All right, go ahead, John.
If James can get at the balun, disconnect this cable, take that SO239 and hit it hard on the palm of his hand, see if he gets any water droplets out. If he does, fill it up with WD-40. That'll displace the water. Might end his problem.
Well, if water is really filling up the inside of the balun, it may require a little more heroics to get rid of that water than just filling it up with WD-40. WD-40, yeah, we'll take the... If the water is only in the connector, I guess the WD-40 will do a good job. But if it's really filling up the balun, I think it might require a little more serious surgery of some kind. Maybe even just drilling a weep hole in the right place to let the water drain out. Or maybe there's already one there, but it's clogged. So your antenna needs quite a bit of inspection, Jim. And after you do all the measuring and inspecting that you can do, if you're still unhappy with the results, it's time you call one of your many friends on this TechNet to come visit your QTH and have another set of eyes and maybe another set of equipment to look at your antenna. That's my suggestion, Jim. KD2BHY, KQLIW. Jim, I think you moved into a bad location with your handy talkie. You haven't set up that antenna yet. We got absolutely nothing on that transmission. Absolutely nothing. We could tell that you made an attempt, but that's all. So try to go back to your good location, wherever that is, and then repeat that last transmission. We got nothing out of it. KD2BHY, K2LIW. Once again, Jim, either the propagation has changed or you've moved to a different location or your handy talkie is putting out less power. We got nothing out of that, I'm sorry to say. So if you can find out what's going on and come back a little bit later, we'll try to continue. But we got nothing out of that last one. Paul, WS2N, what has National Aeronautics and Space Administration been doing? What has that Curiosity been doing? And have they found further evidence? And after you finish, I'm going to maybe pass it over to John briefly, because John made a discovery this week of a new very large object that the space people have discovered. They've discovered a brand new, very large object in space. WS2N, KQRIW. Go ahead, Paul.
This is WS2N. I haven't heard anything lately on Curiosity. I know it's in the drive mode, trying to get it to a certain location, which might take 3 months or so before they get to the foothills of that Mount Sharp. So they'll stop along the way. That's the process they're in now of driving. Every once in a while they'll stop, poke around, and use their equipment, one of their 10 instruments to investigate what's where, and they'll document it, and then they'll continue on. But the goal is to get to the foothills. That's where the real story is going to be. That was the whole idea of going to Gale Crater. Yeah, I just want to talk about a couple of satellite projects that are on the books. We drop it. A new one by Bigelow. It's Orbital Sciences and SpaceX and all these different companies, these private companies. Well, there's one called Bigelow. And they've been in the running since, 1989, and this is the guy that dreamt up the idea of using inflatable structures to create a space station eventually. He's done it, he's on a small scale. He launched Genesis 1 and Genesis 2, and they were about 12 feet long or so, and they inflated it. They're still in orbit today after, I think, 2007 or 2006, they were launched. And they're still operating. In fact, you can go on the net and you can see pictures that they're still taking. So it's a proven technology. It's something even stronger than Kevlar, when the thing inflates. And he wants to eventually make bigger ones. They call them the 300X, which really stands for 300 cubic feet. And he'd be able to put them actually together. You'd have a node in the middle and you put two, three, or four of these things together. And you'd have a tremendous amount of space inside the dropper. And each one of these modules that he plans on building would actually be larger, let's say, than one of the modules on the International Space Station. And with some money, that's what he needs, a little bit more money from NASA, which he was just awarded $17.5 million to proceed with his plan on eventually taking one of these things and you launch it on a spacecraft. And it doesn't have to be a big rocket, but because it's very light, and he'll blow it up in space when it gets near the space station, and they'll attach it to one of the nodes on the space station. He's got the contract now to do that, so the space station will be increasing in size by roughly the size of another module, and you'll be able to put two or three people in a room this size quite comfortably. So he wants to show it that he can do that and eventually build his own space station. Drop it. He contracted out with SpaceX to use the Falcon 9 to put his modules up into space. So eventually, somewhere down the line, you might see another space station. The Bigelow space station. I'd like to see this guy get along, do something. He's had some problems, financial problems. He had to lay people off a while back, and now I understand he's hiring people back. Comes out of Las Vegas. And two other topics. There's something called a satellite called the LDCM. And essentially it's another Landsat satellite that's being built Landsat has been around a long time. There's one that's been up there for 40 years, taking pictures of the ground and the earth and the weather and how the surface of the ground changes. And they've gotten millions of pictures. It's been in orbit for over 150,000 orbits. But it's coming to an end. It's got a failing gyro. And they managed to keep Landsat 5 alive for like forever. So now this new one, Landsat Data Community Mission, they call LDCM, is going to be built. They're almost ready to launch it. But it's almost being finished being built. Probably middle of February. They had a launch date of February 11th, but, you know, that might get pushed back a little bit. You want to put this thing up to replace Landsat 5. It's about 6,000 pounds. They'll use an Atlas 5 to put it up into space. So I thought that'd be pretty good to replace this thing that's been operating. They thought it was going to operate for 3-4 years. Meanwhile, it operated for 40 years. So they want to put another one up there. Let me drop it. And then last but not least, the tracking data relay satellite that was supposed to go up last month. It's got a couple of delays. They needed a launch pad for the X-37, that one by the Defense Department. That's the one that looks like a small shuttle. They had to put that up. So they pushed the thing back a little bit. And on the 29th of this month, a couple of weeks from now, they'll launch that. This is a big satellite, the Kedra satellites. They've been around since, what, 1983? They put a number of them up. The first one that they put up in 83, kind of like fell short of getting to orbit. They have a second stage rocket that it didn't work out. That didn't fire. So, well, actually it fired, but the fuel didn't last as long as they thought it was going to. And it took them some months to use the attitude control rockets to eventually get it up higher and higher to a geosynchronous orbit. Well, that was number one. Number two was a payload on Challenger. So when Challenger blew up, it took the second Tetris satellite with it. Drop it. They've had a series of these things. This is the third generation that's going to be going up at the end of the month. And they put these things up into geosynchronous orbit. And right now there's seven operating ones, and they need one more. And as they fail, they replace them. So that's why you have the three generations. This is going to be the first of the new generation Tetris satellites. They have two more going up mid-year and another one at the end of the year. And set of solar panels on it. The last generation had 2,400 watt power. This thing has 1,000 watts more, 3,400 watt power to power these transmitters. You ever see this thing? I mean, it's huge. It's 60. Last generation one was 69 feet long. I don't have the measurements on this one. Drop it. And it's heavy. I can't find the weight, but the last one was around 7,000 pounds, and this will probably be about the same amount. I know it can't be much more than that because it's going to be launched by an Atlas 5 401, and the 401 designation means that there's not going to be any booster rockets attached to it. So the Atlas 5 lifts roughly around 10,000, a little less than that, 9,000 pounds to geosynchronous orbit. So it's probably in the 7,000 pound area. So it's huge. I mean, it's 67 feet, or 69 feet, I think, but 40 feet wide. So it's a big satellite. And this is the one that you see sometimes in the movies, you know. They'll show a satellite, you know, communicating with somebody down below, teacher's satellite. It's got these two dish antennas. Each one is 15 feet in diameter. And they're usually meant for uplinks from other satellites, and maybe from the Hubble or, you know, from the space shuttle, a lot of science satellites, hundreds of low Earth orbital satellites that need to communicate, including the military ones, use the tracking data relay satellites. And then they have a smaller dish antenna, and that's pretty much the one that beams down. And they have two locations that they use: White Sands, New Mexico, is a receiving center, and they're also in Guam. They're the two main air receiving sites for all these satellites. And they have them distributed around the Earth. This way they have 100% communication to whatever might be going up. The idea, of course, started early 80s when they had the shuttle. Actually, first shuttle flights didn't have any teacher satellites, so you would use a ground network of dozens of these ground satellites. And now you don't need them. You have the two ground stations, and you have eight operating TDRS satellites. TDRS is TDRS, Tracking Data Relay Satellite, and sometimes with an S at the end, system. That involves all of them. So I thought I'd bring that up, Dick. Interesting piece of equipment being built by Boeing, previously built by TRW, and they became part of Northrop Grumman, but now Boeing got the contract for the third gen. Back to you for now, Dick, WS-200.
When it comes to describing the size of a satellite, you can be talking about the length and the width, and you might be including the dish antennas and the solar panels and all kinds of things. When you're talking about this satellite being 69 feet long and 40 feet in diameter, wow. By my standards, that's a huge amount of internal volume. Is that the body of the satellite, independent of the solar panels and the pair of 15-foot dish antennas? If so, that's a real biggie. Back to you on that one, Paul. WS2N, K2RIW.
The body is roughly cube-looking, about a third of that. Yeah, it is. Two main panels, and they are about 30 feet long. So the body is probably, you know, maybe 8 foot by 8 foot, or 10 foot by 10 foot by 10 foot, something like that. And there's also cooling radiators and piping all over this thing. You know, you do have to get rid of the heat caused, you know, by a lot of electronics. Generators, they're using this hemispherical generator thing, so you don't have spinning motors and like you do on the earlier ones. So, you know, they do have, I think, at least five, probably around nine attitude control rockets. You know, that doesn't include the final rocket that can do a 22,500-mile orbit. Pretty interesting. Now, you know, you think about it. I mean, this has been going on since 83. And here we are all these years later. So, you know, some of them have failed, and they've been replaced. So you have seven operational ones now, and then you'll have an eighth. It's incredible. And some of them, they put it like into a parking orbit. They only use it now and then as a backup. But they never want it. Want to have a system where you don't have 100% communication. You can do, of course, data and voice and video and simultaneous satellites could be transmitting off to one antenna and then up to another one. One other thing I wanted to ask you, they say that these are phased array antennas, by the way, Dick. Might put some light on that, why they have that.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Phased array, and why do they need that for space operation?
Almost always, a phased array antenna really means an electronically steerable array, ESA. Once you have individual elements being combined to make a larger antenna array, and once you have the ability to change the amplitude or phase or both of the signal going to the individual elements, you're now well below the threshold, well above the threshold of where you can electronically steer the beam. To electronically steer the beam is, in many cases, a hell of a lot nicer than mechanically steering the beam. You try to take a great big high-gain antenna and swish it in azimuth or elevation because it's a mechanical thing connected to, and with a certain amount of finite mass connected to a satellite. As you steer that antenna, you get an action and reaction problem. You think you're steering the antenna 20 degrees to the left, and yes, as far as the gimbal is concerned, you bent the joint by 20 degrees, but the antenna will move by 10 degrees, and the satellite will move by 10 degrees, if you know what I mean. So mechanically moving an antenna in space is a fairly homely, ugly process. You don't want to do that if you can avoid it. To electronically steer the antenna means that mechanically nothing changes. On top of that, once you've got a phased array, let me drop. You can steer the beam in microseconds instead of seconds and minutes. To mechanically move a very large dish antenna in space is going to take you some number of minutes to do it. And by then, the event may be over. Whereas electronically steering, you can do it in microseconds. In fact, there are cases where an electronically steered antenna can be listening in three directions simultaneously by time sharing. It spends one third of the time in direction A, one third of the time in direction B, and one third of the time in direction C. And if you switch fast enough between those individual directions, you can get essentially full-time performance on those three separate emitters in three separate directions. That's one way of doing it with a quasi-timeshare. There's other ways with a beam steering, with a electronically steered array, you can intentionally do what's called beam spoiling. You can intentionally make the beam width broader or more narrow, or you can simultaneously generate multiple beams. You could truly, in full 100% timing, transmit two or three separate beams in two or three separate directions, and each of those beams are on those locations simultaneously. Once you've got electronic phased array steering capability, boy, you've got antenna beam width, antenna direction, antenna multiple beams. You've got adaptability like you wouldn't believe. Let me drop. The mathematics that goes into this was called the Widrow algorithm, W-I-D-R-O-W. You Google that word, Widrow algorithm, you're going to find some very fancy matrix mathematics, which allows you to predict ahead of time, once you know how many wavelengths wide and high your phased array is, and how many elements inside, how many individual feed points, so to speak, that tells you how much electronic steering, how much electronic adaptability, gives you a lot of information. You can, with an electronically phased array antenna being fed by the Widrow algorithm technique, you could be in a hostile environment steering peaks of beams into the desired emitter directions, simultaneously steering nulls into the directions of the undesired emitters, like jammers, and doing that all at once. Boy, is that adaptability. So, in the case of the TGRIS satellite, you might, on a fraction of the orbit of the International Space Station, aim at it, during a fraction of the orbit of the Hubble Space Telescope, you aim at it. At some other time, you aim at some other satellite, and you can even do some of that work simultaneously with electronic steering. I do know, let me drop, that in earlier years, when I used to be watching NASA Select on my television receive-only terminal, satellite antenna system, the 12-foot type dish, I would be watching NASA Select, I'd be watching the astronauts doing a maneuver on the space shuttle, and as they went around the Earth, you saw this great big map of the Earth with certain exclusion zones where, because of an incomplete array of TDRS satellites, each TDRS satellite presented a certain footprint on the ground, so to speak, and as the space shuttle traversed certain areas in between those footprints, there might be a 10-minute period of time in which there was no coverage by any TDRS satellite, in which case they had to predict this ahead of time and adjust the timing of the transmissions and receptions accordingly. So in the earlier days, there were definite gaps because the complete array of TDRS satellites and complete operability wasn't there. Now, by way of the multiple TDRSs and backups and so on that you're describing to me now, Paul, let me drop. It sounds like they've got complete coverage with even some overlap and backup. And those TDRS satellites saved us a fortune. In the early days of Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo, they had to set up a whole lot of ground stations and a whole lot of so-called downrange trackers. You had a bunch of these ships that you positioned at various places in the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian Ocean so that as the spacecraft flew over that particular chunk of land, the 15-foot dish antenna mounted on that that ship, usually it was a tanker, would aim at the spacecraft, receive the data, relay that data from the ship to some other satellite, and eventually back to NASA. So these downrange trackers were very elaborate, very hard to set up, expensive, and only gave you incomplete coverage. Now with the TDRS satellites, you've got complete coverage, no matter where your spacecraft is over in the Earth's vicinity. So, and most of that downlink of the TDRS satellite to White Sands or to Guam is done on the KU band frequency region, around 15 gigahertz. At one time, I was thinking of setting up a receiving site that could listen to 15 gigahertz, and that way I wouldn't have to worry about, let me drop, positioning my satellite receiving system in order to receive NASA Select, because sometimes NASA Select was unavailable while the astronauts were doing something exciting, and to have complete coverage, I was considering the possibility of building a KU-band receiver to listen to the TDRS downlink. Whether or not in those days it would have been successful is a function of how much encoding they were using in order to create security. I think in the early days there was very little encoding. I guarantee today it's a elaborate digital code with a code of the day and so on. So for a person to simply listening to the KU band downlink of TDRS and get something coherent out of it, I'm guessing those chances are very slim these days. You might have some information on that, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, and they wouldn't have had a problem with HAL 9000 if they had used the phased array.
Okay, very good, thank you. Yeah, and it's KU-KA S-band capability. And that explains a lot with the phased array. But from one of the videos I saw, they showed, in fact, they used the Hubble and they used the space station as an example, flying below. And, one was like kind of like directly below them, and the other one was way off to the side. And they showed a signal being sent up by both. And I forget what the color they used. I think it was a pink coming up, and then they had a downlink going to White Sands, New Mexico, and that was like a green downlink going out at a small antenna. But on a big antenna, he had these signals coming up, and I was wondering, well, don't they got to move the antenna, you know, to get one or the other? I mean, they were far apart. We drop it. The only way that they'd be able to do that then and is with the phased array. So that answers a lot. You know, I was looking for these big actuators on the antenna. I didn't see any. So that's how they're doing it. I mean, they do have momentum gyros type of things to move it a little, you know, one way or the other. And they actually have thrusters too if they wanted to. But, you know, it wouldn't last, you know, a minimum 5-year piece of equipment. And it looks like they last 10 and 20 years on a regular basis. Using up fuel left and right to switch to list all the different spacecraft down below. So phased array is the way they're doing it. Very good, Dick. Yeah, and as far as the size, yeah, it's 69 feet by 40 feet. And I must have went to 30 different sites. I cannot find the weight or the actual size of the new one, but I guess it's probably about the same. Back to you, Dick.
Now, let me show you something else that's going on. I just did a back-of-the-envelope calculation here, Paul. Geosynchronous orbit, geostationary orbit, 22,300 miles out, is a little bit shy of 6 Earth radii away from the center of the Earth. You put a TDRS satellite at that location, looking down at the Earth. The Earth is a little less than 8,000 miles in diameter, 4,000-mile radius. So if you want the beam out of the TDRS satellite to be able to aim at every single point on planet Earth. Planet Earth from that, what's the word I'm looking here for? Perch. Perch is one way. What do you call it? The bosun's chair? No, what do you call the chair that they have at the top of the mast on an old-fashioned sailboat? I can't think of the name of it right now. From that particular catbird seat, the whole darn Earth is only plus or minus 9.5 degrees. If you can electronically steer the beam 9.5 degrees to the right, to the left, and up and down, you can look at every single place on Earth. And for everything that's in low Earth orbit, plus or minus 10 degrees, you only have to steer the beam 10 degrees. A good phased array. Let me drop.
It's a crow's nest, Dick.
That's the word. So from the crow's nest of synchronous orbit, and if you can steer the beam plus or minus 10 degrees, you can look at everything in low Earth orbit, no matter where it is, whether it's a polar orbit or equatorial orbit, doesn't matter. You can steer with every one of those things. A phased array usually can easily be steered plus or minus 30 degrees. To only have to require plus or minus 10 degrees makes it very simple. You can now start building an antenna that's larger than normal, with really fancy techniques to it. So that's an ideal environment for an electronically steered antenna. And as I said, no mechanical motion required. You can steer it in microseconds. You can steer it so fast that you can monitor things multiple times in the same time domain, or generate with a slightly more elaborate phased array, or a slightly more elaborate use of your phasing harness, the way you feed signals to each of the individual elements. You can generate multiple beams simultaneously. That gives you a lot of adaptability. Now, you said it's a phased array, and you talked about a pair of 15-foot diameter dishes. So maybe there is a cluster feed at the focal point of each one of those dishes, and depending on the way you use that cluster feed, that's the phased array that uses the parabolic dish as the main gain producer. Is that approximately what's going on there, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
They did say there were a lot of elements, and I'm assuming that must be part of the focal point. I mean, there were no other elements or, you know, yagis or anything sticking off the end of the satellite. It just looks like the two big dishes and then the one small one. probably part of the focal points to do that. And if you want to look at this, this is a beautiful looking satellite. You just put in TDRS, tracking data relay satellite, TDRS, and then hyphen K, the letter K, Kilo. Doesn't have anything to do with the band, you know, it happens to be, you know, they went alphabetically. Cal and M are going to be going up later this year. But K is the first one of the new generation, it's the third generation of TDRS satellites. And you can look that up and they show you beautiful pictures and, on how this thing looks. And you can compare them to the older ones too. You know, you put in a J or something and you can see the last generation. And that's the best thing to do. And if you see this, if you see the length of it, and you see the weight of it, let me know. I'm sure I'll find out by the time it takes off on the 29th of this month. But it's, my guess is probably similar to the 7,069-foot, 40-foot-wide previous satellites. Back to you, Dick.
The booster that's going to bring it off the Earth, do you know the approximate number of pounds of thrust it has, Paul? Go ahead.
Oh, yeah, that's the Atlas V. They're using the 401 configuration. The Atlas V comes in different configurations, either the 401 or the 501, and then if it has multiple boosters on it, let's say it's going to have two boosters for a 401 flight, you would have the four. It would be a 421 configuration. That would mean four. You know, four meaning the diameter of the fairing, which is in meters, so it's 4 meters in diameter. And then in this case, it's 4010, means no extra boosters. And the one means that you have one upper stage rocket on the stack to push it to geosynchronous orbit. And the thrust for Atlas V, that's the big one that our government has. Right now is the Atlas V. Without the extra boosters, it's around 800,000 pounds on the lift. So it's quite powerful. You know, if you have curiosity, use an Atlas V. I think that was a five. 4-1 setup. New Horizon used a 5. That was the big one. 5-5-1. That had 5 boosters on it. Back to you, Dick.
Wow. 0.8 million pounds of thrust on takeoff for something that's going to go into Earth orbit, and that leaves the Earth vicinity. That's a lot of steam. A lot of energy. I'm going to have to look this one up. So, TDRS K, and that's the 11th, K is the 11th letter of the alphabet, so I guess that's the 11th launching of a TDRS satellite. Is that approximately true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, number one kind of failed to. Eventually they got to geosynchronous orbit, but kind of like ran out of steam. They used it for a lot of Antarctica work. It really never became functional. Number two blew up on a Challenger. And then the other one pretty much made it. And yeah, you're up to the 11th launch. Some have failed, so you have 7 operational ones now. They like to always have 8. Back to you.
Very nice. That's a nice program. Good piece of hardware, and I guess you said Boeing now, and it used to be TRW. Guarantee they enjoyed that contract. Have you ever wondered what it would be like to work in the clean rooms of any of these facilities where they build space?